and welcome to the Sports Pro Podcast. I, very briefly, am Tom Basson, and I'm here to introduce this week's episode. I say very briefly because what you're about to hear is a fascinating panel discussion recorded back in April at Sports Pro Live. To set the scene, to celebrate 10 years of our flagship event, we decided to do a little bit of future gazing and try to predict what the next 10 years in the world of sports might look like. For this job, we are Sports Pro CEO Nick Meacham, Sports Pro Editorial Director Michael Long, and Laura Williamson, Deputy Editor of The Athletic, to get out their crystal balls. The first voice you'll hear is then Sports Pro Commercial Director Paul Guest. And without too much further ado, here is the panel.
How we're going to go through this is the initial sort of 15 minutes or so, we're going to look at macro trends. What do Laura, Mike and Nick think that the macro trends are going to be? Then we're going to move on to some quick fire questions, looking at specific companies. What are they going to look like in 10 years' time? Will they still exist? Some properties. And then we're going to have a look at a bit around major events and mega events as well. So first up, Nick, one of the things that you have been talking a lot about on stage for the last couple of days and that you tend to lead on internally is, what are we going to see over the next 10 years in terms of trends and developments when it comes to content and consumption? Just to start with something small.
Geez, how long have we got? I mean, we see it move at such a rapid rate, right? You're talking about every single sports property is becoming a media business and an entertainment business first. So the investment internally of sports as a whole is only going to continue to grow as media sit to the heart and that content play becomes part of not only the fan relationship, but indeed the commercial relationship they're having with potential partners. You look at the conversation we had even with Spotify and Barcelona yesterday, and they're talking about how they measure success around media value with what they can do in content around the relationship with that organization. So I think you're just going to see further and further investment from every single sports property, significant further investment into that space. And obviously the big thing is the proliferation of short form content. Boards are still trying to work through that. Some organizations, the major professional leagues are much more well positioned. They've been doing this for a long time. But there's a lot of sports properties and sort of the next tiers, the challengers, et cetera, that are still trying to work it all out. And because sponsorship's now harder than ever to secure at the sort of second tier and third tier level, content sits at the heart of that whole business conversation, and they need to unlock that and build something of value. Otherwise, you're going to find it really challenging to turn that audience into something of financial value to the rest of the organization. So I don't know if that's quite the right angle. It's a bit more business-led, but I just think we're going to see further investment heavily into internal teams, creating more and more content. And how long's a piece of string? You're going to see more and more of it. You can't do enough, I think, in this day and age.
Laura, you spent a lot of time in the football industry, more so than other sports, with what Nick's just referenced. What do you think more specifically then, off the back of the investment that Nick is inevitably predicting, what do you think is going to happen over the next 10 years?
I think there's a really interesting conversation about audience for football. I'm primarily talking about Premier League football, but there's no reason that can't include WSL and the women's game as well. At The Athletic, something we're seeing a lot is two very clear audiences, really. This very UK-based, established audience that wants granular detail on their football club. You know, they'd happily read 1,000 words about how the right back's positioned a couple of metres further inside, for example. But then there's this huge and growing audience, mainly based in the States, but all around the world, that is tuning into the game. And to serve them, it's much more about sort of human interest features, the Wrexham story, you know, look how that's gripped everybody. We live blogged on The Athletic. We live blogged Wrexham's game against Boreham Wood, and it outstripped the Premier League content by about 8 times. There is this huge audience there that is still, I suppose, to be cultivated really by content.
Mike, the Wrexham guys this morning were talking a lot about community and what Laura's just mentioned in terms of developing those audiences. I want to bring on to another trend that you've been talking a lot about is using sport as a vehicle to develop communities and possibly to even influence participation. What do you see that trend and that development looking like over the next decade?
To be honest, I think the content and the community go hand in hand, especially when you're talking about building global communities. You know, the content is what drives that, and the distribution of that and getting it outside of your domestic market is really important, I think, to build that profile. But I think when we talk about sport as being a driver of local community, obviously Wrexham a great example, of that as well. But as we're seeing with the cost of living crisis and, you know, a lot of these issues around, you know, as we're seeing with the high street, you know, I don't know if anyone's gone down to their local high street recently, but certainly where I live, you know, there's some challenges there in terms of the community and local businesses struggling and et cetera, et cetera. And I think, you know, what Wrexham have done in bringing awareness to and tourism to Wrexham has been fantastic. I think we're going to see more of that, you know, sport as a community builder and thinking in that way, especially if we continue with the government we have currently and, you know.
I would just add on the community bit. I think we did spend a lot of time today talking about, so the Wrexham piece and what they've done for the local community, but trying to look 10 years ahead rather than just what's happening now is it's all going to be about global and digital, right? So those communities will be fan groups that sit all over the world and they'll be using sports as a way of connecting with people with similar interests. That already exists, but that part, we have not even scratched the surface. We always look at sports and football and so forth about, because the brand of the club is associated with a city, but actually what Wrexham have built or the ownership group has built could be transferred to any place. In theory, now that they've done it, it's going to be a lot more difficult to do that again. But the point is they've created a content, a storytelling opportunity that has connected and resonated with fan groups and people just who love and want to engage with something in this space. And so digital communities will be where everyone will be focused on. They already are. That's why people got so excited about things like metaverse and digital platforms last 12 months, because they know that's where they need to be going. We're talking about sports at such an international level these days, but we're not there yet. It's going to take a number of years before things like those platforms really start playing a meaningful role. But in 10 years, I think we'll get there.
And I think what a fan is, again, talking about football, but what a fan, what a supporter is, will be completely different in 10 years' time. You know, is it about going to see your local team every week, or is it about getting up at 3 a.m. to watch it in a bar in Minnesota? And I think that'll really, really change in the next decade for sure.
We had a governing body in one of our workshops earlier that admitted that 10 years ago, they didn't have a social media channel at all, not even Facebook, which by that point had been around for at least 7 or 8 years. You mentioned the metaverse, Nick. There's a lot of discussion about it, and there's a lot of people saying they might start dipping their toe and they're going to do it. What does that look like in 10 years' time? Is it a similar level impact to social media? What's your big call?
Well, firstly, on the example with the NGB having a social account, well, I'd say that a lot of pro teams in sports didn't have those accounts. I think Man United, if I remember, was one of the last movers in that space. F1 is another example. I think 10 years ago, they may not have had much of a, if any, social presence. I'm not ready to put all my chips in on the metaverse world, but I do believe that some version of this digital community bit is going to be absolutely front and center. Look, you've got this tension between in sports as an entertainment product with this balance between lean in and lean back experiences. Some people just want to watch sports, live sports, sit back and watch it and chill. Other people really want to get immersed in it. They really want to connect with fans. They really want to moan about their performance. They really want to celebrate when those performances are. You know, your platforms like Roblox we had here yesterday, you can see the formula ingredients there. But even when I'm talking to them, they're finding it incredibly difficult to get anywhere with talking to some of the sports properties, because they're looking in the next year or two, what can they get out of it? And fundamentally, for those things to work, it's going to take several years, and it's going to take several iterations of the technology and a change in behavior of fans and consumers for that to even have a chance of succeeding. Fundamentally, the content media economic model in sports is pretty broken. Like, you know, if you think about how sports generates income from consumption, it's live sports. But I would argue live sports is the least amount of content time I have with most of the sports I follow. Yet the sports itself make £0 out of that more often than not. So that has to flip somehow, some way.
Mike, how does that flip?
When we look to the future, I think we should try and retain the essence of sport, which is participation. I think, yes, you can serve people through their phones and on their armchairs, but you've got to get people out of that mode as well and put on a fantastic live experience and get people down into their local communities competing and playing in sport. I think participation is the best gateway to creating lifelong fans and getting people to engage with the content. The content can't be the be all and end all to creating the community. And I think that's very important. And that's going to always be important, you know, whether we're talking about the next 10 years or the next 100 years.
Laura, we've seen certainly on stage the last couple of days, but also in things like when we produce our 50 most marketable athletes ranking, the influence that has on content production, engagement, communities, participation. What's the athlete's role going to change in the next 10 years? How does that develop within all of these? And I realise that is a very, very broad question.
I think they become more and more important. And I think we'll see a sort of trend for following individual athletes, perhaps more than club allegiance. Again, talking about football, but it applies to other sports. I think that's something we see that's perhaps come from gaming. That, I don't know, if you've always played Haaland, you know, and then he joins Manchester City, you have an interest in Manchester City and what they're doing. So I think athletes as individuals will be able to harness that interest and take people with them. And then you get into a debate about, well, how do you keep the authenticity of a fan experience if, you know, if somebody can have three teams because that player has played for three different clubs? So I think that's going to be a really interesting debate. But I think the opportunity is there for athletes to certainly harness the interest in them as individuals, for sure.
One of the things that we had a chat about when we were going through the briefing sessions of this was the role of athletes now almost having to hold some of the rights holders accountable. And obviously one of the better examples of that is with the Saudi tourism announcement for the Women's FIFA World Cup this year, and the pressure and the immediate reaction from some of the big profile players like Megan Rapinoe, and it was almost immediate. How much of that did play a part in the change in direction, inevitably by FIFA? Do you think that is only going to become more and more of a barrier between that relationship between these stakeholders?
Yeah, I mean, to explain that one, the Women's World Cup has got a sort of individual commercial plan away from usual FIFA sponsors, you know, Coca-Cola, etc. You know, great idea. But then they brought Visit Saudi on board. The FIFA would say straight away it was never formally announced, all the rest of it, but that deal was signed. And just this assumption that that would be okay for a tournament involving women and involving a lot of openly gay women. It's quite extraordinary that they thought they'd just sneak that under the under the barrier and no one had noticed. The Athletic actually broke that story, and there was backlash from the local organiser committee in Australia and New Zealand, some minimal government intervention. But the big thing was Alex Morgan standing up and saying, no, I'm not having this. I'm not happy. I wasn't consulted. And it was really, really telling that that's what moved the needle. That's why that announcement will not be made, because it's been quietly scrapped. And I think if you compare that to what happened with the Men's World Cup in Qatar, there was weeks and weeks and weeks about whether to wear an armband, never mind to stand up and say, no, I'm not having this. So I think, again, that showed that, I mean, that was in a press conference, but it could easily have been a statement on social media or whatever. I think that shows how powerful these athletes are. And I mean, I would say this, I suppose, but, you know, fair dues to the female athletes for standing up and using that voice.
Mike, you lead in our 50 most marketable athletes ranking that's into its 14th year now. Most marketable athletes, 24, 10 years time. What does that look like? How does that change? You mentioned yesterday morning, the average age of the top five athletes last year, I think, was 37 years old. Is that going to keep going up, or are we going to see the likes of Sky Brown, who I think was 13 years old and she was in at the top 50 last year?
That's a good question. We could ask the guys at North Star, because we work with them on the ranking. But to be honest, I'm not sure. I think that average age of 37 for the top five last year was very much down to the fact that that was a pretty unique decade we've just been through with some of those long-established stars and the longevity that they've had. So I think it's more about the way that athletes can speak to their audiences now, and the content they can create, and the direct communication that you can have through many, many different platforms. You know, anyone that's doing that well and producing fantastic content is going to resonate, and they can come from any different sport. You know, we've spoken with North Star about Alex Honnold and Free Solo, and, you know, he's not in a mainstream sport, but he's a fantastically well-known, well, you know, talented individual who's got a lot of strings to his bow. And I think that's very, very important, and it's going to become increasingly important. Age is irrelevant, I think, in that respect.
But before we move on to the quick fire rounds that we're going to be picking on specific organisations, one of the topics, Nick, that I know you think is going to develop or maybe needs to develop over the next 10 years is, Laura alluded to it with the likes of FIFA's involvement in the Women's World Cup sponsorship this year. What does the role of the governing body look like over the next 10 years, and what should it look like?
It's a big question. You know, the term governing body says it's what it's supposed to be, but what it's being expected of and demanded is completely different now. You know, they're asked to become experts across all sorts of commercial avenues. They're asked to create content and media output because that's the way you connect with your audiences from grassroots up. And it's more challenging time than ever to generate income commercially for these organizations. They don't have the right funding models in place. And also the goalposts move a lot, or have been moving a lot in the UK, but also in the international markets.
It's really difficult if you're a governing body this day and age to be able to generate income, build a meaningful audience, and ultimately run a self-sustaining organization. You were Ryan back, government started putting pressure on UK sports governing bodies to start becoming self-funding. There's incredible amounts of effort to try that. And guess what? It's really bloody hard. And in fact, they realize they can't do that model. And also they've looked at, you can't just look at sports at the elite end. Sports organizations, sports governing bodies have such a bigger role to play if they're well structured and well supported and funded. That participation, the leisure aspects, that, you know, now we live in a society where getting people active is really difficult. That's the part of the role I think they should be really focused on. But they can't do that without being well funded. And that is really challenging if brands aren't willing to support it, which they're not. They're looking for content and storytelling. That's what they want. So it's a really difficult time for governing bodies, I think, generally. You look at the international federation landscape, similar sort of situation. All the international federations are at the beck and call of the IOC because that's where the money comes in. And we've even seen what the IOC's done at Engace, the federation, the governing body for federations being effectively shut down, I believe, Mike, if that's correct. So that power, that challenge of trying to become something more than a governing body is really, really difficult. Now, the most interesting example, I think, on an international federation perspective right now is probably the volleyball example, where they've received CVC and private equity money to create a commercial arm and to create a proper commercial private business to try and grow that part of the game and let the governing body focus on the governance. I'm not saying it's a perfect model. There's a lot of catches when you bring private equity to the game, as we've seen in rugby and other sports. But I think that delineation, rather than governing bodies and federations trying to be everything to the whole sport, is really where that we have to see a definitive line drawn, and the funding model has to be such that that's supported wholeheartedly by government and other structures.
I wonder if that's part of the success of Formula One and the Liberty Media deal, and that you don't have to worry about participation, do you? It's not about growing the game and getting more kids in cars. They can concentrate on growing it commercially, and you know, the success of the documentary speaks for itself.
But I think they also see the value in engaging people as well, through not only through the content, but with their F1 arcade kind of initiative, taking simulators and giving people a sense of what it's like to participate in the F1. Obviously, they're thinking about building those fans by giving them those touch points, those physical touch points, which I kind of alluded to before. But I think we're going to see a lot more of that over the coming years, of that licensing of IP, perhaps with a gaming element, Top Golf style model, where these, you know, not necessarily governing bodies, but the more commercially minded properties out there are going out and really trying to reach people in that way, as well as through the screen, if you like.
We've been quite broad brush so far with those macro trends. Frankly, we could do an entire day on that. Each of them have been prompted beforehand, so this isn't quite off the cuff. But each of the three of them have picked an organization specifically to say, hey, this is what that organization is going to look like in 10 years. And it is a big organization, a significant player at the moment. So Mike, we're going to start with you. What's your organization and what do you think the change is going to happen to the organization over the next decade?
I picked Amazon for this because I think, obviously, hot topic, increasingly invested in sport, certainly in recent years. And I think they can be, they have the means to be so much within sport. They could have a huge impact moving forward as a kind of rights buyer, a streamer, a content aggregator, an online retailer, as we know. But they have obviously many other tentacles within sport, AWS, for example, on the cloud computing side, and their Just Walk Out technology, and, you know, checkoutless concessions in venues and things like that. So they're going to have a huge influence, I think. They have the potential to have a huge influence, and not just positively as well. I think there's potentially some negative influence. We spoke to a load of people in the live events industry recently for a live events week that we did, venue operators in particular, and they were saying that actually Amazon's a huge competitor now for their staff on the food, on the hospitality side. And so I think it's not to say what Amazon is going to look like in 10 years, but in terms of their impact in sport, could be so many different things, positive and negative. So I think, you know, we'll all be monitoring them pretty closely, or we should be if we're not already.
I was expecting a Nostradamus moonshot of saying, well, Jeff Bezos is focusing more and more on space. There's going to be sports on the moon at some point. If you get it right, you look great. Anyway, Laura, what was the organization that you've gone for?
I picked Twitter. Maybe because it was the day I lost my blue tick, but I'm not sure. The toxicity of a platform that has been such a force for good, actually, for sport and content is quite sad to see, to be perfectly honest. Missed the days of the old Friday follows when it was all very pleasant. But just think in terms of curated content, which is what we see people want, and I think what they're going to want even more of going forward, now it's all changed on Twitter. I think that makes it very difficult for it to be used as a news feed like it used to be with sport. And, you know, if you were an Arsenal fan, you could follow everything to do with Arsenal, and that was brilliant. And now that's interrupted, I do think people will find other places to get their news.
Do you think the inherent polarisation of audiences in discussion on Twitter, and from what was published a couple of weeks ago, it looks like the algorithm is almost trying to accelerate that. Do you think Twitter's going to end up as one side or the other? Do you think it's going to be left or it's going to be right? Or do you think, is it still going to exist? And is it going to remain a platform for legitimate discussion, or is it just going to be an echo chamber of, you all agree with me, let's get angry?
Yeah, I think it's nearly there, to be perfectly honest, and it's going to the right, because people who are left-leaning find other ways, or, you know, speak to people rather than ranting online, perhaps. But that echo chamber thing is absolutely right, and it will. I think that's just a negative spiral, really.
Nick, which organisation have you gone for?
I still haven't made a decision right now, so I'm going to just say a word that comes to mind and we'll go with it. I'll go with BBC. BBC, we had Barbara Slater on yesterday talking about the role of BBC in the sporting landscape in the UK and what they're doing to cover sports. And she also talked a lot about the challenges. You know, the media rights values are going up and up and up, and their funding's becoming less and less and less. And so they're struggling to be the platform, therefore, for major live sports rights in this market. And I think 10 years from now, where they're going to have to be, I can't see that changing. I can't see them getting more money out of the blue unless the whole BBC changes. So therefore, they're going to not have any live sporting events in the future, because it's too attractive for all those major streaming players and OTT platforms and other commercial broadcasters to snap up those rights. And those commercial platforms will have the distribution capabilities by then to make sure they're on as many platforms as possible. But I think BBC's role, what it should be and could be, is an incredibly valuable platform. I think the stat that Barbara used yesterday was 6% of all live sports events are on free-to-air TV, which equates to 60% of the audience for live sports in the UK. And it shows the importance, not the top-tier fan. The top-tier fan will go find it. The top-tier fan will go pay for it. But the ability to stumble across a sport and engage with something new is being completely lost in this fragmented world of sports media. Yeah, you have to be looking for it to find it. And social media can play a role, but you're never going to fall onto the live sporting experience. You're going to be looking at highlight clips. So BBC's role can be a real enabler for tier two and tier three sports properties and so forth to have a legitimate platform to connect to the audiences. And being a UK-based broadcaster, be focused on British sports and prioritising giving them the platform and supporting them in production and content creation to really double down on being the enabler for those organisations. Because if it's left to them, it's going to be an uphill battle to ever be able to get any meaningful cut through versus the likes of the Premier League and those major players that have next to unlimited resources to be positioned for the future world of digital media.
How do you think that happens, though?
It needs to be a decision made at their end. They accept that they can't compete financially. They're going to keep fighting for those major events, you know, the Wimbledons, the Silverstones that they do support. But that would just start, I believe, will start to wane over time. There'll be less and less of that on the platform as every rights holder is getting some big, massive checks being presented to them at the top end. And they have to focus on what they want to serve and deliver to the British community, because that's ultimately who their priorities are. But they do an incredible job of what they produce from an editorial perspective on their platforms. And that will continue to be a really important mechanism for education and awareness. But they need to turn that into giving them also a platform for the more premium proposition, which is live sports.
So the final section they're going for, each of the panelists have basically been asked to choose one challenger property. And with the challenger sports property, so a sports organisation, a rights holder, A, will that challenger still exist in 10 years' time? If they won't, why not? And if they will, why will they still exist and what will they look like? Mike, which one have you gone for?
So I picked LIV Golf. I think it will exist, possibly, but definitely not in its current form. We've seen they've come with a pretty abrasive, brash, kind of loud approach to the market, and they've made a huge amount of noise, as we all know, backed by Saudi billions, and they've poached a lot of talent from PGA Tour and European Tour, et cetera, et cetera. It's caused huge disruption within golf, for sure. But the jury remains out on whether the team model works. Let's face it, does anyone know a LIV Golf team off the top of their heads? Some pretty crap names there anyway.
Range Goats, I think, is one of them. But I think the team model works in golf when it's US Ryder Cup, you know, US versus Europe, red against blue, very easy to understand. When there's a load of teams, you know, with no real geographical rooting or allegiances, it's pretty hard to build fandom around that. So I think that model will probably need to be rethought. And obviously they've struggled for airtime and they've struggled for commercial revenue from sponsorship, et cetera, et cetera. So really, I think the sell will need to change for them to be successful and to really, I guess, get to the point of commercial viability long term. So I think it will still exist, but very different.
Laura, which sports organisation did you go for?
I picked the European Super League, so A22, as it's now known. And yeah, it's so here. It's not going away. You know, that extraordinary day in April when it felt like, well, our world, the football world, erupted. And, you know, there are still challenges in the courts. And I think the outcome of that challenge is going to be fascinating, not just for football, but for all European sport. The idea that it could be challenged, that no, football isn't different to everything else in Europe, and you can't have a monopoly. And why should UEFA run it just because they've run it for however many years? And I think seeing how that plays out is going to be fascinating. And that challenger model to the Champions League and the established elite is not going to go away. It'll be there in some form.
I know we didn't talk about this beforehand, but what do you think the impact on UEFA will be then? If European Super League does get traction, what do you think happens to UEFA then within the next 10 years?
I think it has to adapt. And I think the way it would do that is by looking at the Champions League. And if you're talking about a 39th game in the Premier League, I think we'll see games in the States happen in the Champions League before it happens in the Premier League. I think UEFA will have to adapt because three of its biggest beasts, especially the two Spanish clubs, Barcelona and Real Madrid, who are fighting amongst themselves at the moment over something different, but they need them. So there's got to be a sort of sop to what they want, I think.
And Nick, which property did you go for? Did you pick one ahead of time?
I did. I got inspired by the venue we're in, and I'll pick the 100, and maybe a bit controversial given I'm here, but my view is that property will not exist in 10 years. I don't think you can have four different versions of the sport of cricket on an already crazy packed calendar. I love their approach. I love what they've done to connect with families. I love everything they've done. But I do think if you sprinkle that onto the T20, they would have had a similar result. That's my view. There's nuance to that. When I've talked to a cricket organisation, they said, look, the jury's out. A lot of successes, a lot of positivity. And I'm not saying it's been a failure. I'm saying it's been really successful in what they've done. But I can't see how they can live side by side in a market like England or in the UK. I think they will have to either completely change approach, because it's not going to be something I don't think you're going to see pop up in lots of other countries in the near future. The approach could be transferred. And we've seen what's happened in India. Like, the IPL is going to become the lifeblood of the cricketing community from a professional perspective, which is going to make it increasingly difficult for new competitions to come in and try and take market share.
Do you think that the investment that's just been announced around the WIPL as well just adds fuel to that? That part of the 100's appeal was the split, but actually now when you're seeing an independent property like the WIPL, it possibly pulls cold water on the future of the 100.
I don't know about that. I would just say it just shows, again, we've talked a lot about women's sports these last few days, and the entire industry is talking about it a lot. It just shows that there's a real commercial validation of investing into women's sports, and there's an audience there for it. So I think you're going to see more and more of that. I think I would argue that the approach that they've done with 100 validates that as well. But again, that I think even for some of the T20 matches that they're having this season, they're going to take that doubleheader approach like they are with 100 with the women and men's game. So if they're doing that, then again, we're getting closer and closer to the similar product and proposition, and that approach to driving it towards families could absolutely be taken by any sports property. It doesn't just have to be the 100.
Which, based on some of the panels before, is not necessarily the right approach, because just replicating the men's model is not necessarily the best model, but also not necessarily the best model specifically for women's sport. Right, to wrap up, we've got some questions coming through. Top question is, how do more and more globalised sports fan communities consume sports sustainably, e.g. air travel? And Laura, you mentioned things like the 39th game. What are your thoughts?
It's very difficult to marry those two things, sustainability and taking sport to its global audience. We were talking before, we spoke about people's need for authenticity and being attracted to sport because of its tradition and because of, you know, things that have gone before. But does the sustainability come into that authenticity? I think it's very difficult to marry it.
I mean, in short, my view would be is that that's where the digital side comes in. And the notion of going to an event live is actually like almost a dream that a lot of international fans, looking at a local, different ball game, but international fans, they can have the dream of one day going to that venue. And instead, they'll consume it with digital communities, through digital channels. And that will be the core way that sports is consumed. It already is that way, but I think it's going to become just more important. And then one day in the future, that opportunity to go and watch a game live will be such an incredible opportunity once in a blue moon when they travel. And that will make ultimately people travel less more generally if they go into less live events.
Avatars. Maybe that's what it'll be in 10 years' time. Avatars in stadiums.
That'll be the same way we cut out for this session.
Yeah, whether it's sport or any other industry, it's pretty hard to reconcile globalization and just outright growth with sustainability. As you know, Paul, you know, we spoke about it earlier in the sustainability sessions. It's going to be tough to do that. You can minimize the impact of events, etc., but all of that scope 3 emissions, etc., of fan travel, you can't mitigate for that. It's pretty difficult, especially, you know, if we talk about the very top end of sport, Olympics, World Cups, they're massive events, aren't they? It's pretty hard to do those sustainably.
We're going to go for, do you think there will be any new roles in sports that we've not seen before in 10 years? I'd also ask as well, because that's probably a yes, the roles that are starting to emerge, do you think they will change in terms of priority within an organization? So for instance, a decade ago, when Man United started their digital transformation journey, there may have only been one person in that team. And now the whole organization seems to be being driven towards that by people like Phil Lynch. So what are the new roles, or do you see a different weighting within roles that already exist within organizations?
I would say in short, you're going to see a big push towards direct-to-consumer more and more and more, still more content creation, therefore more broadcast content creation, and therefore actual people who specialize and are experts in broadcasting will be a key focus internally. At the moment, you've got teams that are kind of a bit of social, a bit of content creation on the written form. They're doing a bit of everything in sports properties. And I think you're going to see that basically become at the heart and soul. There is a fundamental gap in understanding of like how to broadcast live sports in a sports organization and in the actual broadcasting world. And that gap has to be really bridged over the next few years. It won't happen overnight. So a big focus on broadcasting and expertise in that space, technologically and otherwise.
Nick, Laura, Mike, thank you so much for sharing your predictions. We will be making sound bites out of all of those. Absolutely holding you to all 3 of those. For everybody tuning in, thank you so much for your questions that you put forward, for sticking around with us for 2 days. And now I'll hand back to Christina.